This is the second series of G. Iger Jeff's All and Everything, Meetings with Remarkable Men. Chapter 3, My First Tutor. As I have already mentioned in the previous chapter, my first tutor was Dean Borsch. He was at that time Dean of the Kars Military Cathedral and was the highest spiritual authority for the whole of that region conquered not long before by Russia. He became for me, through quite accidental life circumstances, so to say, a factor for the second stratum of my present individuality. While I was attending the Kars Municipal School, choristers for the choir of the Fortress Cathedral were being chosen from among the pupils of this school, and I, having then a good voice, was one of those chosen. From then on I went to this Russian cathedral for singing and practices. The fine-looking old dean, who was interested in the new choir chiefly because the melodies of the various sacred canticles to be sung that year were of his own composition, often came to our practices, and, loving children, he was very kind to us little choristers. Soon, for some reason or other, he began to be especially kind to me, perhaps because for a child I had an exceptionally good voice, which stood out even in a big choir when I sang second voice, or perhaps simply because I was very mischievous and he liked such rascals. In any case, he began to show an increasing interest in me, and soon even began to help me prepare my school lessons. Towards the end of the year, I did not come to the cathedral for a whole week because of having contracted trachoma. Learning of this, the Father Dean himself came to our house, bringing with him two military physicians who were eye specialists. My father was at home when he came, and after the doctors had examined me and left, having decided to send an assistant to give me a copper sulfate cauterization twice a day and apply golden ointment every 3 hours, these two men, who had lived their lives to old age relatively normally, with almost identical convictions, in spite of having received their preparation for a responsible age in entirely different conditions, talked with each other for the first time. From this very first meeting they took to each other, and afterwards the old dean often came to see my father in the workshop, where, sitting on the soft shavings at the back of the shop and drinking coffee made there by my father, they would converse for hours on all sorts of religious and historical subjects. I remember how especially animated the dean would become when my father said anything about Assyria, about the history of which my father knew a great deal, and which for some reason or other at that time greatly interested Father Borsch. Father Borsch was then 70 years old. He was tall, thin, with a fine-looking face, of delicate health but strong and firm in spirit. He was a man distinguished by the depth and breadth of his knowledge, and his life and views were quite different from those of the people round him, who in consequence considered him peculiar. And indeed, his outer life gave grounds for such an opinion, if it were only for the fact that, although he was very well off and received a large allowance and the right to special quarters, he occupied only one room and a kitchen in the guard's house at the cathedral, whereas his assistant priests, who received much less than he, lived in quarters of from 6 to 10 rooms with every kind of comfort. He led a very secluded life, mixing very little with those round him and paying no visits to acquaintances. At that time he allowed no one access to his room except myself and his orderly, which was not, however, allowed to enter it in his absence. Conscientiously fulfilling his obligations, he gave all his spare time to science, especially to astronomy and chemistry, and sometimes, for a rest, he worked at music, playing the violin or composing sacred canticles, some of which came to be very well known in Russia. Several of these canticles, which had been composed in my presence, I happened to hear many years later on the gramophone, for example, O Thou Almighty God, Calm Light, Glory to Thee, and others. The dean often came to see my father, usually in the evenings when they were both free from their duties. In order, as he said, not to lead others into temptation, he tried to make these visits inconspicuously, since he occupied a very eminent position in the town, and almost everyone knew him by sight, whereas my father was only a simple carpenter. During one of the talks which took place before me in my father's workshop, the dean began to talk about me and my studies. He said that he saw in me a very capable boy, and that he considered it senseless for me to stay in school and drag out the 8-year period merely in order to receive at the end a 3-class certificate. And, in fact, the arrangement of the municipal schools was then quite absurd. The school consisted of 8 grades, and one was compelled to attend each grade for a year, receiving a final certificate equivalent only to the first 3 classes in a higher school. That is why Father Borsch advised my father so convincingly to take me away from school and have me taught at home, promising to give me some of the lessons himself. He said that, if I should need a certificate later on, I could simply take, in any school, the examination for the corresponding class. After a family council, this was settled. I left school, and from then on Father Borsch undertook my education, teaching me some subjects himself and also providing other teachers for me. At first, these teachers were the candidates for the priesthood. Ponomarenko and Krestovsky, graduates of the theological seminary who were serving as deacons at the cathedral while waiting for posts as army chaplains. A physician, Sokolov, also gave me lessons. Ponomarenko taught me geography and history, Krestovsky, scripture and Russian, Sokolov, anatomy and physiology. Mathematics and other subjects were taught me by the dean himself. I began to study very hard. Although I was very capable, and learning came very easily to me, I nevertheless scarcely found time to prepare so many lessons, and rarely had a single moment free. A great deal of time was spent in going and coming from the house of one teacher to that of another, as they lived in different districts. Particularly long was the walk to Sokolov, who lived at the military hospital in Fort Chakmak, 3 or 4 miles from the town. My father had first intended for me the priesthood, but Father Borsch had a quite particular conception of what a real priest should be. According to his notion, a priest should not only care for the souls of the members of his flock, but should know all about their bodily diseases and how to cure them. As he conceived it, the duties of a priest should be combined with those of a physician. He said, just as a physician who does not have access to the soul of his patient cannot be of any real help to him, so also one cannot be a good priest without being at the same time a physician, because the body and soul are interconnected, and it is often impossible to cure the one when the cause of the illness lies in the other. He was in favor of my having a medical education, though not in the ordinary sense, but as he understood it, that is, with the aim of becoming a physician for the body and a confessor for the soul. I myself, however, was drawn towards quite another way of life. Having had from my early childhood an inclination for making all sorts of things, I dreamed of technical specialization. As at first it was not definitely decided which way I was to go, I began at the same time to prepare myself to be a priest and a physician, the more so since there were certain subjects necessary in both cases. Afterwards, things continued by themselves, and I, being capable, was able to progress in both directions. I even found time to read a great many books on various subjects, either given to me by Father Borsch or which fell into my hands. The Father Dean worked intensively with me in the subjects he had undertaken to teach me. Often after the lessons he let me stay with him, gave me tea, and sometimes asked me to sing some canticle he had just composed to verify the transcription for the voices. During these frequent and extended visits, he would have long conversations with me, either on the subjects of the lessons I had just finished, or on quite abstract questions, and little by little, such a relationship was formed between us, he began to talk to me as to an equal. I soon got used to him, and the feeling of shyness I at first had towards him disappeared. Retaining all my respect for him, I nevertheless sometimes forgot myself and began to argue with him, which did not in the least offend him, but, as I now understand, even pleased him. In his conversations with me, he often spoke about the question of sex. Concerning sexual desire, he once told me the following. If a youth but once gratify this lust before reaching adulthood, then the same would happen to him as happened to the historical Esau, who for a single mess of pottage sold his birthright, that is, the welfare of his whole life. Because if a youth yields to this temptation even once, he will lose for the rest of his life the possibility of being a man of real worth. The gratification of lust before adulthood is like pouring alcohol into Malavalian Magyar. Magyar is very new, not yet fermented wine or must. Just as from a jar into which even a single drop of alcohol has been poured, only vinegar is obtained and never wine, so the gratification of lust before adulthood leads to a youth becoming a monstrosity. But when the youth is grown up, then he can do whatever he likes, just as with Magyar. When it is already wine, you can put as much alcohol in it as you like. Not only will it not be spoiled, but you can obtain whatever strength you please. Father Borsch had a very original idea of the world and of man. His views on man and the aim of man's existence differed completely from those of the people round him and from everything I had heard or garnered from my reading. I will mention here certain thoughts of his which may serve to illustrate the understanding he had of man and what he expected of him. He said, "Until adulthood, man is not responsible for any of his acts, good or bad, voluntary or involuntary. Solely responsible are the people close to him who have undertaken, consciously or owing to accidental circumstances, the obligation of preparing him for responsible life. The years of youth are for every human being, whether male or female, the period given for the further development of the initial conception in the mother's womb up to, so to say, its full completion. From this time on, that is, from the moment the process of his development is finished, a man becomes personally responsible for all his voluntary and involuntary manifestations. According to laws of nature elucidated and verified through many centuries of observation by people of pure reason, this process of development is finished in males between the ages of 20 and 23, and in females between the ages of 15 and 19, depending on the geographical conditions of the place of their arising and formation. As elucidated by wise men of past epochs, these age periods have been established by nature, according to law, for the acquisition of independent being with personal responsibility for all one's manifestations, but unfortunately, at the present time they are hardly recognized at all. And this, in my opinion, is owing chiefly to the negligent attitude in contemporary education towards the question of sex, a question which plays the most important role in the life of everyone. And as regards responsibility for their acts, most contemporary people who have reached or even somewhat passed the age of adulthood, strange as it may seem at first glance, may prove to be not responsible for any of their manifestations, and this, in my opinion, can be considered conforming to law. One of the chief causes of this absurdity is that, at this age, contemporary people in most cases lack the corresponding type of the opposite sex necessary, according to law, for the completion of their type, which, from causes not dependent on them but on suing, so to say, from great laws, is in itself a something not complete. At this age, a person who does not have near him a corresponding type of the opposite sex for the completion of his incomplete type is nonetheless subject to the laws of nature and so cannot remain without gratification of his sexual needs. Coming in contact with a type not corresponding to his own and, owing to the law of polarity, falling in certain respects under the influence of this non-corresponding type, he loses, involuntarily and imperceptibly, almost all the typical manifestations of his individuality. That is why it is absolutely necessary for every person, in the process of his responsible life, to have beside him a person of the opposite sex of corresponding type for mutual completion in every respect. This imperative necessity was, among other things, providentially well understood by our remote ancestors in almost all past epochs, and, in order to create conditions for a more or less normal collective existence, they considered it their chief task to be able to make as well and exactly as possible the choice of types from opposite sexes. Most of the ancient peoples even had the custom of making these choices between the two sexes, or betrothals, in the boy's 7th year with a girl 1 year old. From this time on, the two families of the future couple, thus early betrothed, were under the mutual obligation of assisting the correspondence in both children of all the habits inculcated in the course of growth, such as inclinations, enthusiasms, tastes, and so on. I also very well remember that on another occasion the Father Dean said, "In order that at responsible age a man may be a real man and not a parasite, his education must without fail be based on the following 10 principles. From early childhood there should be instilled in the child belief in receiving punishment for disobedience, hope of receiving reward only for merit, love of God but indifference to the saints, remorse of conscience for the ill treatment of animals, fear of grieving parents and teachers, fearlessness towards devils, snakes, and mice, joy in being content merely with what one has, sorrow at the loss of the goodwill of others, patient endurance of pain and hunger, the striving early to earn one's bread." To my great distress, I did not happen to be present during the last days of this worthy and, for our time, remarkable man, in order to pay my last debt of earthly life to him, my unforgettable tutor, my second father. One Sunday, many years after his death, the priests and congregation of the Kars Military Cathedral were much astonished and interested when a man quite unknown in the neighborhood requested the full funeral service to be held over a lonely and forgotten grave, the only one within the grounds of the cathedral. And they saw how this stranger with difficulty held back his tears and, having generously recompensed the priests and without looking at anyone, told the coachman to drive to the station. "Rest in peace, dear teacher. I do not know whether I have justified or am justifying your dreams, but the commandments you gave me I have never once in all my life broken."